Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Ian Rutter, and he'll be answering your most important questions about fishing southern Appalachia trout waters. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Ian a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and click on the link below the description of the show that says, click here to ask Ian your most important question. We'll receive your questions immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them on the show tonight as possible. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. Content of this broadcast is copyrighted and the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Ian about southern Appalachia trout fishing. The Nantahala River in western North Carolina near the Great Smoky Mountains is a renowned destination for whitewater adventurers and fly fishing fanatics. It also offers some one-of-a-kind privileges, such as being one of the nation's top trout streams, night fishing, and last but not least, Mystic River, the only whitewater riverfront community in the eastern U.S. The promise of an unrivaled setting can be yours if you act fast. Mystic River on the Nantahala is releasing its final 15 home sites of this natural treasure. Now is the last chance ever. Call 866-977-4455 or visit mysticriverland.com. That's 866-977-4455 or online at mysticriverland.com. Well, before we introduce Ian, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight for our drawing. Tonight, we'll be giving away an autographed copy of Ian's book, Rise, Rings, and Rhododendron, Fly Fishing the Mountain Streams and Tailwaters of Southern Appalachia. We'll also be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have 3 chances to win tonight. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Ian's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. Our guest tonight is Ian Rutter. Ian lives in Townsend, Tennessee with his wife Charity and their daughter Willow in the shadow of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. He is a partner in R&R Fly Fishing Smoky Mountain Guide Service and spends almost every day on the water, either wading the streams of the Smokies, drifting one of the East Tennessee's great tailwaters or cold water lakes, or floating one of the several smallmouth bass rivers. In 2001, Ian decided to seriously pursue outdoor writing and photography. Ian has written several books that highlight fly fishing in the Southeast. His books include Great Smoky Mountains National Park Angler's Companion, Tennessee Trout Waters Blue Ribbon Guide, and his newest release, Rise, Rings, and Rhododendron, Fly Fishing the Streams and Tailwaters of Southern Appalachia. Ian has also hosted the Fly Fishing Eastern Freestone Streams DVD series, and his photography appears in all of his books, and his articles and photographs have appeared in a number of national magazines. Ian serves on the board of the Little River chapter of Trout Unlimited in East Tennessee. He works regularly with fisheries biologists in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park on native brook trout restoration projects, as well as an annual trout population surveys of his home waters. Ian guides anglers on the wild trout streams of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. He also guides anglers from a drift boat on the Clinch, Holston, and Tuckasegee Rivers. Ian, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hey, Roger. Good to be here.
Well, I know you've had a long day. You just came off from a float today with some clients. So long days for guides and public speakers, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Living the dream, as we say.
Well, it's hard work. We all know that, but that's how you learn about the water, right? And learn
that's
about
right.
The fish, and there's only so much book reading you can do, and you got to get out there. So
that's right, and you see a lot of things when you're there every day, and pick up on the subtle things, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, exactly. Well, You know, the title of our show is Southern Appalachia Trout Fishing. That covers a really large area when we think about it. That you know, looking at the map here, it's like saying the Southern Rockies or the Southern Sierras. I mean, we're covering a lot of ground. So tonight, first of all, I'd like you to kind of describe the greater Appalachia area, and then we're going to focus primarily on the park and the Smokies area that that you're so familiar with. Sure. So can you kind of give us a greater picture of that area?
Yeah. It does cover a lot of ground, like you said, but it's not as much as saying like the upper Midwest or the northern Rockies. You've got East Tennessee, which really isn't that much. You probably go out maybe 15 miles in a straight line out from the Tennessee border, and then you've got western North Carolina, which holds a good portion of it, and that extends south into North Georgia, and you're talking north of Atlanta. There, once you get down to Atlanta, you've got the Chattahoochee tailwater, and then that's about it. You're about out of trout going south from there. But it's a mountainous region, actually more mountainous than some people would believe. We tend to get a little aggravated sometimes with western guys that say, you know, you've got 6,000-foot mountains. Those aren't mountains. You know, we've got the big mountains. But we have vertical relief of over 5,000 feet, you know, from our peaks down to the valleys in a lot of instances. So they're pretty big mountains, and we have a lot of streams. The region has several thousand miles of freestone streams and a good number of tailwater rivers, which you're talking about tailwaters that are probably 100 years or less old. You know, these were probably smallmouth rivers or warm water rivers that after dams have been in place, these rivers and a tail race are now really high-quality trout water. There's a few cold water lakes along the North Carolina-Tennessee border. There's four pretty high-quality ones that are very good, and I don't mean just kind of the, you know, state throw some trout in there and, you know, in August they kind of go belly up, but I mean these are cold water lakes that have even wild trout in them to a certain degree.
And holdovers, huh?
Holdovers. And wild trout. They have natural trout streams that go into them. So, I mean, there's fish that come and go and will spawn. And so it's a great variety of water, not just mountain streams and not just tailwater. So there's a whole lot of stuff, and I haven't even mentioned, you know, smallmouth, which is another thing that really doesn't get much press at all, and I'm probably as guilty as anyone of being a real trout head and kind of neglecting the smallies, but we probably have almost as much good smallmouth water in this part of the country as we do trout water. So
well, that's that exciting too. Fishing too.
Yeah, and really in this part of the world, bass fishermen tend to be the guys that are on the big lakes and the high horsepower, high speed boats, and the guys that fish the streams and rivers tend to be trout fishermen, so a lot of the smallmouth tend to get a free ride and just don't ever see fishermen for the most part.
I'll have to remember that.
Yeah.
Because we've got plenty of trout out here in Colorado, but not any
smallmouth.
Yeah. So, and I think they're a blast to get on.
Oh, absolutely. We caught a few today, just kind of, I hate to say it, but as bycatch.
Yeah. That's all right. It's funny when you do that. It's you know, even you out here, you know, the bycatch many times is a whitefish, right? But you know, I personally don't have a big problem catching whitefish. They fight pretty darn good, and they come in a pretty good size, nobody minds if you keep one of those and smoke it, which you know. I don't have a big problem with those anyway. But so you did mention, you've talked about some larger lakes, some tailwaters, and, of course, we've got the streams. And, I mean, we're talking about rivers that can be floated, and then working your way up into the kind of water that's, you know, a little brook, so to speak, or mountain streams that are very small up in the park, right?
Yes. And, you know, when people come to the Smokies, they kind of think about showing up and just having a brush-choked stream that they could literally just kind of hop across, and that isn't the case. I mean, we have some of those, but the more popular streams and the streams that people are most familiar with in this part of the country, at least, are pretty good-sized trout streams. And in the spring, during the higher flows, you wouldn't be able to wade across them for the depths and the flow. So there are some pretty good-sized streams that are freestoners in this part of the world, too. So it's not all just little stuff, but we've got a lot of higher elevation streams. And when I say higher elevation, I'm generally talking between 3,500 and 5,500 feet. And 5,500 would pretty much be maxing out. They're going to get really small, just a dribble beyond that in elevation.
Well, I have a question here from P.J. McElhone in Rome, Georgia, and he wants to know what your favorite water is on the Tennessee-Georgia border.
That hones in pretty tight. Really a good tailwater that even in this part of the country isn't really that well recognized would be the Toccoa, which is in Georgia and flows into Tennessee, and that comes from the base of Blue Ridge Dam at near Blue Ridge, Georgia, and that's a very good tailwater. I've fished it several times. I'm not near as familiar with it as several friends of mine are, but that's a pretty good tailwater, and it can be floated. It's a long float. The put-ins and takeouts aren't that close together, so it can. You can't spend too much time in any one spot, and I know that a lot of times when fishing conditions are optimum, the flows are kind of low, so there's a lot of boat walking and dragging to floating that. But I'm aware of a number of large brown trout that have come out of the Toccoa over the past few years, and it's got good dry fly fishing, and that's a real good one. And another one, it's not right on the border, but just a little north of there would be the Hiwassee tailwater, and I've spent a lot of time on the Hiwassee over the years and always liked that river. It's a big tailwater that's in the middle of a national forest and absolutely no development along the banks. It's just a big river in the mountains and almost has a western feel to it in size. It's got a lot of boulders and ledges and just a neat river, too.
Well, it sounds as though, and from my reading on the area, I've never been to your area there, but it sounds like there's just a ton of different kinds of fishing to be had there.
Yes, there is. And, the topography of the area makes it seem a little bigger than what it is. Because of the mountains, there aren't a whole lot of roads in these national forests or national parks. And what roads there are, you kind of have to take a rather circuitous type of route to get some places. And actually, Hazel Creek is, we're going to talk about that later, I think, but that's one of the more famous streams in the park, and it's kind of remote, but just to get to a place where I can kind of start to jump off to even approach Hazel Creek from my home in Townsend takes me about 2 hours or thereabouts, you know, to get to where I can even start my walk or boat ride to Hazel Creek. But if I get on Google Earth and draw a straight line from my driveway to the campsite where I stay at Hazel Creek, it's 15 miles in a straight line. So, we have a lot of water. Yeah, we got a lot of water jammed into a relatively small geographic area. The national park is 600,000 acres and has about 800 miles of trout water inside of it. So, a lot of mileage.
And we're talking there about the Great Smoky Mountains National Park.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike Reeves from Morristown, Tennessee. I don't know if that's near you or not.
Yeah, it's not too far.
Oh, yeah, I see it up there a little northeast of Knoxville, looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants to know what your favorite water in the park is, or is there a tailwater that you prefer? That's kind of a loaded question.
Yeah, it is. It is. I've lived right here almost within spitting distance, a little river, which comes out of the park through Townsend. And I guess like a lot of people who have something in their backyard, you don't think as much of it. And for years, whenever I had a day off or something, I would always leave and go somewhere else to go fishing. And the more places I've fished in terms of mountain streams, I have a hard time finding one that's as good as Little River, which is my home water. And then in terms of tailwaters, you can't really compare them equally. You kind of have to, they're apples and oranges. The South Holston tailwater up in Upper East Tennessee is, I think that's as good a river as you could find about anywhere. Just incredible dry fly fishing, good populations of wild fish, good size fish. They eat dry flies. They eat streamers. They kind of do all the things I really like to do. So in a tailwater, I would have to put South Holston kind of top of my list. And just because it's just far enough, I can't be there whenever I want. It's kind of got that little bit of extra sugar coating on it. You know, it's kind of a treat when I head that way, I guess.
Sure. Well, we've got a question that came in here from Paige. Paige is actually a guide up Kenny Creek Lodge and Outfitters up in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And her question is, what is the length of the season there? And I'd like to extend that question and say, well, you know, can you fish there all year round? Are there closed seasons?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of go through that with us.
Yeah, actually, I would say in recent years, folks from that part of the country and New England and the Mid-Atlantic are kind of starting to discover this. We don't have a closed season, at least in Tennessee. There is none. North Carolina only has 1 month that's closed, and their wild water is open year-round. I'm not as up on the Georgia waters, but I think it's very similar to North Carolina on their regulations. But in terms of a fishing season of fishability, we start getting dry fly fishing. Our first good mayfly hatches of the year start in March and go through May. And then the tailwaters are fishing good all through the summer. And then the mountains have some olive hatches again in the fall. And it's a very reliable dry fly fishery from March to about Thanksgiving. And, you know, if it's kind of a mild fall, early winter, that can go all the way to Christmas. So we only usually have about 9 weeks of the year where it's kind of tough. And usually the tailwaters will kind of pick up the slack. I mean, it might be cold outside, but the tailwater water temperatures don't really vary that much from
right.
the middle of summer to the middle of the winter. And, friends, I was just talking about the South Holston. The winter, there can be some phenomenal olive hatches. And usually in the winter, I'll watch the extended weather forecast, pick the worst weather day to schedule a trip to go to South Holston and drive up there and hope for spitting snow or drizzle or something, and fish dries in January. So it's a great place down here where you can get a good jump on your season if you're from somewhere up north where, you know, the fishing doesn't really kick in till April or May.
Yeah, or you're ice fishing.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Do you get a midge hatch during the wintertime like we get out west?
On the tailwaters, for sure. And, you know, the mountain fish eat midges, but you'd be pretty hard-pressed to find anybody that really fished midges. The only river, the only freestoner I could really think of where I know they fish midge patterns would be the Davidson near Brevard, North Carolina. And that's a really popular stream. It's known for some pretty large fish. And I know it gets a lot of pressure, and those fish really get pretty finicky. And I know that they do fish a lot of midge patterns over on the Davidson, but it's pretty much the Watauga, the Clinch, and the South Holston where people are fishing midges on the tailwaters with you know, real reliability around here. You know, in the wintertime, we're kind of fishing number 10 or number 12 prince nymphs or something in the mountains.
Oh, big stuff, huh?
Yeah, and they'll eat
well,
it.
Well, Ian, we need to take a little break here. So when we come back, we'll talk to Ian more about Southern Appalachia trout fishing. So hang tight, folks. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects in both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the mangrove recovery initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of the rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and helped with the Striped Bass Game Fish 2006 Symposium in Foxborough, Massachusetts last year, just to name a few. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. And to continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Ian Rutter about Southern Appalachia trout fishing. If you'd like to ask Ian a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and click on the link below the description of the show that says, click here to ask Ian your most important question. We'll receive your questions immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them on the show tonight as possible. Well, Ian, just before we get back to the fishing, tell us a little bit about your business, what you do on a daily basis. And
sure.
You're based out of Tennessee, is that correct?
Sure, yeah. We're in East Tennessee, right on the edge of Great Smoky Mountains National Park. I have a guide service. My wife and I are partners in that. We both guide. We have a couple other guides that work with us regularly, and it's all full-time job for us. It's what we do. And you can see more about it at www.randrflyfishing.com. And you can find our books and videos there on the website. And we also do a couple of special things every year. We do a camp trip over to Hazel Creek where we guide fishermen and have a camp set up and do all the cooking and take care of all that stuff, and it's a great time, and you don't even have to be guided. You can just go along for the food and the camp and fish on your own. And we do one of those in the fall and one of those in the spring. And every September we take a group of folks out west to the Madison and have a big time out there. And every February we take a group of folks down to Belize and do some saltwater fishing. So we stay busy year-round. And any of that stuff you can see on our website at randrflyfishing.com.
And that's R and then and spelled out?
Yes, yeah, spell it out. That's right.
Yeah. R and then A-N-D-R and flyfishing.com.
Correct.
And you can find that link on Ian's speakers page on our website. So if you didn't get that, just go there and it'll directly link you to his site. Good. And, yeah, it sounded you mentioned your books. You've been kind of prolific writer over the past few years and getting lots of things published.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I worked in a fly shop for about 5 or 6 years and was answering the same questions every day and thought, well, you know, I could probably write a book of all this, and decided to do that. So, and kind of the perspective I took on it was when I was trying to figure my way around, what information was I looking for? What would have really helped me out?
Right.
So I've tried to make it as species-specific as I can, because I know that a lot of times I was out hunting places where the brook trout were or looking for places where the browns were, so I've tried to delineate that as best I can and also kind of give people a bit of what to expect in terms of how big the stream is, because sometimes you know, something sounds good, but, man, it is tight. And personally, I kind of enjoy that, but I know a lot of people just can't stand it.
Yeah. So, it's challenging. I know
yeah.
We were interviewing Jeff Currier, and he was doing it at the World Fly Fishing Championship
mm-hmm.
last year in Portugal. And he said he was crawling on his hands and knees up the stream and bow and arrow casting to get under the trees.
mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a lot of work to catch a fish. So.
Well, it is. And, you know, and I would say that's one of the biggest misconceptions about this part of the country is that fly fishing in the mountain streams is a bit of a physical experience that a lot of people don't even quite think about, but it's very uneven footing. And the fish are so skittish that after you've fished a pool, a pocket, or a run, you know, you fish it, you do what you're going to do, and then you got to move. And at the end of the day, if you fished it effectively, you will have covered a lot of territory and, you know, rocky, slick stuff. So.
Well, what good timing. We just got a question in here from Wally Swift in California. He says, Ian, as a guide, what do you do to keep in shape for running up and down the streams all day?
You know, that's almost like a joke here recently, because I took a guy fishing and I ran up and down the creek with him all day, and the next day I rode a boat all day, and he said, what kind of exercise program do you do? And I said, that's it. You've done my exercise program.
Yeah,
I just
yeah.
run up and down a creek all day, and if I'm not, I row a boat. So,
yeah. Been doing it so long that you're always in shape, right?
Yeah. Well, it seems that way. That's for sure.
Yeah.
It'll keep you tight.
Got another question that came in here too. Chris in South Carolina asks, and I'm not sure how to read this question, but maybe you can help me.
Mm-hmm.
During warm summer months, when the water temperatures tend to rise, are the streams of the Great Smoky Mountains, and they just got in quotes, safe to fish, or should anglers stick to tailwaters? And I'm not too sure what Chris means by that.
He's probably worried about stressing fish, I would imagine.
Oh, okay.
Is probably what he's getting at there. Usually, they are. That usually is not a problem. I will say this: the fish, when they get like that, they're not real easy to catch. I mean, they're pretty sluggish. They don't want to come out, so they're not really easy to catch in the first place. And as somebody that's got to go out and help folks catch fish on a daily basis, I tend to move up in elevation through the summer. Where the water's cooler, just to find the more active and happy fish anyway. But it's pretty rare that, at least in the national park, that you're going to have some temperature issues. And usually what you end up doing is when you start getting into temperature issues on a regular basis, you're kind of starting to move into smallmouth water. And you might as well just take off your royal wolf or beadhead pheasant tail or whatever trout type of thing and put on a woolly bugger or maybe a zuddler or something or maybe even a popper that's going to get a smallmouth and, you know, have some fun doing that and give the trout a break there.
Well, another question that came to my mind was being that the park is on the border of Tennessee and South Carolina, do you need to get licenses for both states, or is there a park license, or how does that work there?
Okay, and it's North Carolina.
I mean North Carolina,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
And actually, the way that works is inside the national park, either a Tennessee or a North Carolina license is valid anywhere inside the national park.
No matter what side of the border you're on.
And no matter where you are in the park, either state's license works. And this is kind of an oddball sort of thing, but a trout permit or stamp, however you want to phrase it, is not required by the national park. And even though if you're in the park, more than likely you're trout fishing, you don't have to have that trout stamp. And the main reason for that is that when you buy either North Carolina or Tennessee's trout permit, you are providing funding for that state's cold water fisheries fund, whether it goes to stocking or whatever. And the National Park gets no part of that funding. So they really don't care if you're making, you know, a financial contribution to Tennessee or North Carolina's trout stocking. So all they require is the basic state license. So you don't even have to go all the way out. If you're just visiting and you're only planning on visiting and fishing the park, you don't have to get the full trout license, just the basic fishing license.
Great. Well, that's convenient. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a nice way to work that license. I was kind of curious about that because that makes it real easy on people that are coming from out of state. Let's move into, we'll talk more specifically about a few areas here, folks, tonight. We're going to try to hit Little River, Cataloochee Creek, Abrams Creek, Hazel Creek, and the Nantahala River.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to talk a little bit about each one of those areas to try to give you a feel even more close up, more magnified than what we've done already of the areas. But right now, let's talk, Ian, for a minute about the types of trout that are in these areas and
mm-hmm.
you know, which ones are native, which ones are planted,
sure.
and so forth.
Sure. Almost anywhere you go, you're going to have rainbow trout. That's pretty universal, and they've been introduced, of course, as you know, they're just native over on the West Coast, but they are wild throughout the national park and in many areas of the national forest. They'd be wild and in some of the tailwaters, but all the states, Georgia, Tennessee, North Carolina, all stock them in state waters where they stock. We have brown trout throughout the area, and I would say North Carolina probably has some of the best freestone brown trout streams, and it's pretty rare to have a stream with only browns. They're usually intermingled in with the rainbows in streams. And then we've got brook trout in some places, and the brook trout are almost entirely relegated to the higher elevation streams above 3,500 feet, except where they would be stocked. And that would mostly be North Carolina. North Carolina stocks a lot of streams with brook trout, and you can catch some pretty large brook trout. They stock some pretty big ones in some of the rivers, and that's a lot of fun to catch a big old slobby-looking brook trout, especially when you're used to catching 8 and 9 inch ones being big in the Smokies.
Right.
But we have some, actually a separate strain of brook trout here in the southeast that has been identified genetically as a separate strain of brook trout from brook trout that would be Virginia North. So the
okay.
Tennessee, North Carolina, and Georgia wild brook trout are distinguished. And they don't have a whole lot of physical differences. They tend to be a little more red than northern fish, and they also tend to be a bit smaller. But at the same time, they're a little more prolific. I'll just say that they'll spawn in greater numbers than northern fish will, so they can populate a stream pretty quickly if after a flood washout or a drought or something to that effect. But an interesting point is that rainbow trout and cutthroats have kind of the same lineage and are kind of distantly related and can actually interbreed. And from the same genetic DNA type of analysis, they've seen that the southern brook trout is actually further removed from northern brook trout than rainbows and cutthroats are removed from each other, which kind of I find to be an interesting fact.
Yeah, that answers Kevin Brady's question from Coatesville, Pennsylvania. He was wondering about
yeah.
that. Now, isn't it a brook trout is not really a trout but a char, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we think of, you know, normally we think of char up in Alaska and Canada, but but it's
correct.
Actually a small char that and I just learned that today, in fact.
And, well, actually, how they got here and how the reason why they're separate and everything is during the last ice age, glaciers, you know, covered most of the north, and where the New River Gorge is around southwest Virginia and West Virginia and that little part of the country, there was actually a large dam created by glaciers with a big lake on the other side of it. And as the glaciers grew, this lake grew in depth, and these waters that held char spilled over into the south and into southern drainages and introduced these fish. And then when the glaciers receded, the lake disappeared. There was no water flowing in from the north, and now these fish are kind of stranded here in the south with no way to get out.
Really, yeah. truly a cold water fish that stayed at the higher elevations. Then.
Correct. Correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We got a question here from Stephen Lamb in Georgia, and this is almost, I almost was wondering if he's talking about basketball here for a second, but says, which stream holds the larger brookies, North Carolina or Tennessee? And he's discussing which basketball team is better, right? But is there a size difference from the North Carolina side over the Tennessee side?
Well, probably not. I can think in my mind that in the national park, there's two streams that have good populations of brook trout that are pretty good size. and they're both pretty much in the middle of nowhere. The Raven Fork is in North Carolina, and that's a pretty big stream by Smoky Mountain standards, and it's not entirely pure brook trout. There's some rainbows have infiltrated that, but I would think of it as a brook trout stream, and because of its size, it's got some pretty good ones. And the middle prong of the Little Pigeon River in Tennessee is also kind of in the middle of nowhere once it gets to brook trout status, but it's still a pretty big stream. So it's big, but I would think overall, in terms of wild brook trout water, North Carolina's got more streams that are larger.
Okay.
That would probably hold. I can think of a couple of other streams. I can think of Snowbird Creek and a few other streams that are pretty large by brook trout stream standards in the South. And I'd like to mention that pretty much most, not all, but most of the water in this part of the country that has rainbows and browns in it now was just about all brook trout water before the 1920s. And it was the logging era and all that type of stuff that really kind of put the nail in the coffin of the brook trout as being the major predominant fish of this part of the country. And it was, I mean, the logging kind of knocked them out. But people at the time saw that the fish were disappearing, so they thought they were doing themselves a big favor, and they started throwing in the rainbow trout, which is a lot of fun, but it kind of replaced the brook trout. And the wild brook trout has just never been able to get a foothold back in these larger streams again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, they don't grow as big and
fast
as.
Although it's kind of interesting because you would think that they probably would, and, you know, in the West it's the exact opposite. You know, the brook trout gets introduced there and it runs everything off.
Yeah.
In the streams in the high streams in the West. So.
Right. Well, are there any really big fish in these, like in the tailwater areas? You know, 20, 24 inchers.
Yeah, actually. You know, in the clinch, there's browns that are 20 and 24 pounds clinch, actually. And the tailwater's a resounding yes on that. The clinch is probably the best known for big brown trout. And the Tennessee state record brown is 28 pounds and came out of the clinch. And every year, there's usually somebody that gets their picture in the paper that's fishing hardware, throwing a big plug or something that mm-hmm. catches a 15 or 20-pound brown trout out of the clinch every year. And the South Holston has a pretty good number of fish that would probably be in that 10 to 20-pound range as well, maybe a few exceeding that as well. The Tocoa, that I said earlier, I've seen some photographs and know some guys have caught some 20 to 24 inch fish out of Tocoa, the Watauga in upper East Tennessee, actually the Nantahala, North Carolina state record came out of the Nantahala, and I believe it was 24 pounds.
Wow.
And that was in the tailwater section of the Nantahala, which really is not that big a river. I mean, comparing it to the Clinch or the Tennessee tailwaters, it's a much smaller river, and a 24 pound fish is, I mean, that's huge anywhere, regardless.
That's huge anywhere. Yeah.
But to look at that water and think 24 pounds is extra impressive.
Well, Ian, we need to take a little break again here. And when we come back, we'll talk with you about equipment, patches, flies, that kind of thing. And then we'll get into some of these creeks. Sound good?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Ian Rutter about Southern Appalachia trout fishing. If you'd like to ask Ian a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and click on the link below the description of the show that says, click here to ask Ian your most important question. We'll receive your questions immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, so let's, we've talked about fish equipment. If I'm coming out there from Colorado, what do I need to bring, Ian?
Well, I was just talking to a guy about this today, and it, with the mountain streams and the tailwaters, it's almost like you have to have two setups at least. But for the mountain streams, you want a lighter rod, not necessarily a shorter rod, but a lighter rod. And I would say a four weight is just a good all-round size rod for the mountain streams. 8 to 8.5 feet will get it for most of the streams. If you're getting into the smaller water, 8.5 feet is probably going to be kind of pushing it. You might want to knock it down to about 7.5 or 7 feet. But, you know, an 8-foot full weight is a pretty universal rod for the Smokies. If you're tailwater fishing, I would say about a 9-foot 5-weight for the standard nymph and dry fly fishing. I'll get you with some streamers. And if you're kind of somebody that's hunting, headhunting the big stuff, and you're floating under high water, you might want to bring a 6 or 7 weight with a super fast sink tip and some 4-inch long or bigger streamers, you know. But that's kind of a specialty niche thing.
Sure.
So 9-foot 5-weight on the tailwaters, and, you know, between 7.5 and 8.5 foot for the mountain streams, although 9 foot is fine on the bigger streams. You don't really need to go too much shorter. You know, don't think short so much as just light. Just keep it light.
Right. And we're talking, as far as line goes, pretty much floating line with the exception of what you just mentioned when you're trying to go deep with streamers or something.
Yes, exactly. Floating line is really all you need for the park. And I'll admit to using a sink tip in the park, but it's like for a couple of hours at a time, maybe 3 to 6 times a year. So it's kind of a specialty type of thing, usually with some high water after a thunderstorm or something, and I'm trying to find that big fish on the end of my line that I've seen all year long.
Right, right. Well, before we talk about hatches and flies, a question just came in, and it's dealing with fish still again, so I'll jump back here for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Travis Daly in Clarksville, Tennessee says, I have been hearing a lot about tiger trout in the Smokies, the hybrid between female browns and male brooks.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if this was true or if it was a rumor, because I have not come across them though throughout my fly fishing experience in the Smokies.
I would probably chalk that up more to rumor than fact. I know what he's talking about, but I would think that would almost have to be hatchery induced. You know, that's when you get the melt of one crossed on the eggs of the other, and I just don't know if you can kind of get them to spawn together. And
being
real
a char and a trout, I'm wondering if they're compatible. But.
Well, and see, they do make that fish, and it's kind of a, I guess, you know, like a hatchery special.
Oh, they do. It is possible.
Yeah, that's what that thing is, and it's a sterile crossbreed, and there's a leopard trout and a tiger trout, and it depends on, I forget which is which, but in one case, the male is the brown and the female is the brook, and the other, the male is, you know, so it's vice versa. And one has kind of spots like a big spots like a jaguar or leopard, and the other has stripes like a tiger, and they're, the spots or the stripes are kind of yellowish, and the fish is a dark color. But in the wild, I just don't know that they're going to do that in the wild. I would think that would
they're
be
not
pretty
trying,
rare.
Okay, so they're not trying to stock those anywhere or anything?
No, and I guess I think some people do that in some creek someplace. But I do know it's a sterile fish. It's not capable of reproducing.
Kind of like the tiger muskie. Huh?
I guess.
Yeah, cross between a pike and a muskie.
Mm-hmm.
That becomes sterile as well. Okay, well, I just want to, because that question just came in, I want to jump on that right away.
Mm-hmm.
You had mentioned kind of the hatches throughout the year, and are they pretty much the same throughout the Smoky area there? I mean,
the elevation is the biggest factor. Things kind of start in the low elevations and work their way up into the higher elevations. And the first big hatches that we see, that we get excited about, I guess I should say, are quill gordons and blue quills. And that's usually March, sometimes as early as late February, but usually first 2 weeks of March, somewhere in there. And that kind of starts on Little River and Abrams Creek and Deep Creek and Nantahala and, you know, the lower elevation streams. And as the month goes on, they'll kind of work their way up into the higher elevations. But later in the spring, we get our sulfurs and light Cahills and the yellow Sally, which is the little yellow stonefly. That's usually late April into May, and that's best right before dark. That's when you get the best egg-laying flights. But you'll see those yellow Sallies all the way through the summer, just kind of very sporadically, just here and there. And then when you get in, also in the spring, we'll get Hendricksons. Trying to think. Seems like all the major mayflies, we get a good number of caddis, several stoneflies, we get brown stoneflies. And then things kind of go quiet in the summer with hatches. We get some trichos and stuff, but it's not that big of a deal. And there's, I guess, some midges and some other things, but it's more terrestrials than anything. And then in the fall, we get some olives and some little caddis, actually, in the fall as well. That's kind of the main thing in the fall is caddis and olives. And in the winter, you get a few olives, a few caddis, a few little winter stoneflies. There's always something happening, but it just kind of, the winter, some days are great, and other days are just kind of sparse.
Well, it sounds as like there's quite a variety of bugs out there.
Absolutely, there sure is. In fact, I know a fellow who's been putting together kind of a DVD series where he's showing all these different bugs, and he's kind of doing it for a national thing, but he was telling me how he was able to get almost like 85% or some ridiculously high percentage of his bug specimens here in the Smokies, because we have such a high variety of bugs here. And we have a tremendous variety, but we don't have a lot of density. You know, we're not going to get these blanket hatches of caddis or betis or anything like that. But it'll be enough to get the fish's attention and get them up. But it's pretty rare that it gets them very selective. You know, I know a few guys that still throw the old thunderhead, which is a local pattern that if you can envision a royal wolf and the body is just gray dubbing. You know, it's white wings, brown hackle, gray dubbing, and a brown tail. And, you know, some guys, that's about the only fly they fish is the old thunderhead, and, you know, they catch plenty of fish. So our fish aren't always real savvy, but, you know, that's good too.
Yeah, that sounds like it was made out of somebody's old sock or something, you know. Wrap that gray on there and put a feather on, and you got a fly.
Mm-hmm.
We do have a question from Justin Daly in Clarksville, Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to know choice of flies during this time of year. So that would be, what, the sulfur?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I guess summer fishing here. And
For the
Smokies, that would be terrestrials, kind of think terrestrials. I'm a big fan of ants. I've been kind of going to ants a lot over the past few years and doing really well. And little foam ants, parachute ants work good. And there's a lot of folks that like inchworm patterns. I don't fish inchworm patterns near as much as probably I suppose I should. But, you know, something just about as simple as a little chartreuse version of the San Juan worm, but a little smaller is kind of what I'm talking about. And you get these little inchworms that are making little silk, they'll kind of dangle down out of trees on a little thread of silk and often just get blown in, or their silk breaks and they fall in the stream. And fish do jump all over a little green bodied inchworm. And I seem to recall not that long ago, a few years ago over on the Nantahala, I was talking to a guide I just happened to run into by chance while I was over there one day fishing, who had a customer in the previous week catch a pretty big brown trout on a inchworm pattern over the Nantahala in the middle of summer. So that's another good thing to use in the summer.
You use one thing that's quite popular out here over the past few years has been the little beetles. Do you use those?
Yeah. I like beetles quite a bit. And just the main thing from a guiding perspective is just getting a fly that people can see. You know, with the ant and the beetle both, if it doesn't have something on there to see, you get something that's not that big and it's black and it goes into the riffly water with a dapple light and shade, and it can just disappear instantly. So, but yeah, certainly.
Do you tie them with a little white tab on the top? Or?
Yeah. I usually use a little piece of Antron just because it catches light a little bit. It seems like it kind of sparkles a little bit more than just a piece of white poly yarn or something.
Okay. Well, let's talk about some of these creeks and rivers. And as we go through there, if there are particular patterns that you find as your favorites for those areas, please let us know. One that you had asked to talk about was pretty close to your own backyard here, the Little River.
Mm-hmm.
So where is that, and how would you get there?
Sure, it's on the Tennessee side of the National Park. If you were to look on a map, it wouldn't be that far from Gatlinburg. It doesn't really go through Gatlinburg, but a lot of people are more familiar with that area, and it starts way up high off the slopes of Clingman's Dome, which is one of the highest points in the eastern U.S., and picks up some steam, comes on out of the mountains, at least the higher mountains around Elkmont, which is a campground in the national park, and from there down to Townsend flows for about 15 miles alongside a road, so you have really good access, and in my opinion, it is one of the better, if not best, brown trout streams in the Smokies, and because of its accessibility, it's one of the more popular streams with fishermen, but it's also been intensively studied by the biologists because it's easy to get to, and they have kind of extrapolated out that there's about 25 brown trout per mile that are over 16 inches, which you know, compared to a lot of western rivers like the Madison or something, doesn't sound like much. But when you look at a mountain stream around here, they're not that large, and a lot of people don't even think there's fish up to 12 inches in these streams. So it's got a lot of nice fish in there if you're into that sort of thing. And I don't catch them very frequently myself, but we've caught several fish over the years up to and even above 24 inches, and my wife, Charity, actually guided a beginner last fall, to a 24-inch brown in the Smokies, which is a kind of ridiculous type of statistic. Somebody's been ruined for life now.
Yeah, I was just going to say, that's what they're going to expect every time, huh?
But actually, Little River...
Charity set the bar there for
us. Yeah, that's right. And actually, Little River has about 3,000 trout per mile in that roadside stretch below Elkmont, which is another pretty good figure. You know, 3,000 trout per mile in a relatively small stream. It's not that small, but I guess in Colorado, the best thing I could, it reminds me a lot of the Big Thompson in terms of size and stuff.
Oh, okay.
In Rocky Mountain National Park. It's very similar, I think, in layout to the Big Thompson.
So not really one that you could float.
No, not at all. Not at all. No, it's a weight-only setup. An average fish is going to be 6 to 9 inches. There's more 10 to 12-inch fish in there than people realize, but, you know, they're a lot more savvy, and there's more 14 to 16-inch fish in there than people realize. And then once you've gotten over a foot long, you're probably in maybe just 10% or less of the fish population. And I think that 16-inch and up class is somewhere in the 2 to 3% of the population. So it's just a really small number. But then again, like I said, you could probably walk up and down the river and pick 25 spots for a big fish to be and be halfway accurate. You know?
Yeah. Now, how long is the stretch that you can actually fish, or that is good fishing there?
Well, it's easy fishing for 15 miles along the road, just in terms of you can just pull up, trip right out of the car, fall in the water. Beyond that, it's trailside access only, and you've got about almost 4 miles before the stream forks. So you've got a good bit of access where you're just walking along the creek, and as almost anywhere, every step you put between yourself and your car, the number of anglers will fall off dramatically. So you still got a good-sized stream with some good-sized browns for several miles beyond the end of the road.
Any particular hatches that are better on that stream than others?
I don't know. Let's say, I would say the Quill Gordon hatch is always good in the spring on Little River, always real good. In April and May, it always has real good Yellow Sally egg-laying flights in the evenings. Get some good Hendricksons, maybe more than I've seen on other streams. And then in the fall, it usually has good olive hatches in the fall. That's usually a pretty reliable thing, where you might get them here and there on the other streams, but you always get a lot of fish up sipping those in the fall.
And any particular patterns that you like for that?
Well, I'm probably the world's worst about really being Mr. One-Trick Pony, I guess, on flies, but I've always been a diehard Parachute Adams man, I have to admit. But in different sizes, in the fall, I will tie a little Parachute Olive that's about an 18 or 20 with a neon orange post made of turkey flats. And I like to fish that quite a bit in the fall, just because it's easy to see and really small. So, you know, fool the fish really well, really effectively, but that bright orange wing doesn't put them off, and you can see the fly really well.
All right, you're in good company, because I read somewhere recently that Parachute Adams is one of the most popular flies for trout, I think, in the world.
Well, you know, I've one thing I say all the time is 50 million trout have been wrong.
Yeah, have been wrong. There you go. Okay, let's talk about then, anything else you want to say about the Little River before we move on?
Oh, that I'd say that probably covers it.
Okay, and this is a freestone creek?
Yes, yeah, everything, that's in the national park. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's in the park, okay.
Yeah.
And then what about Cataloochee Creek? That seems to be a popular destination.
Yeah, it is, and Cataloochee is probably one of the more easily accessible streams that you have to work at to get to, and what I mean by easily accessible is you don't have to have a strong set of legs and a will to walk miles to get to it. You can drive to it, but because of its kind of less than convenient location, it's very rarely ever got a big crowd on it. It's just inside North Carolina, about 20 miles inside North Carolina from Tennessee, and I think it's exit 20 off of I-40. And once you get off that exit, it takes you about 30 minutes to get in there. And it's actually a lot easier to get to than it used to be because they've paved most of the road between the interstate and Cataloochee Valley. And it used to be gravel the entire way. And you could also take the Waterville exit right at the Tennessee state line and take a 26-mile dirt road to get there. So, I mean, it used to be that you had to knock your fillings loose to get back to Cataloochee Creek. But it's a beautiful area that the park maintains kind of like when the pioneers were first there. So it's got some open meadows and one of the few streams in the national park that actually flows through open fields and isn't necessarily all wooded and brushy all around it. So that's kind of a unique type of factor. So at this time of year, you can go over there and fish some cricket and hopper and beetle patterns and do pretty well. And it's also a real good brown trout stream. And I don't know if its brown trout numbers are as dense as Little River's, but I always remember the fisheries biologist always talking about how usually every year the biggest brown trout that they would shock up would come up out of Cataloochee Creek. So it's got some big ones over there as well. And they've recently reintroduced elk into the Smokies, and that's been over at Cataloochee. So that's another little side item that kind of a fun thing to do that you don't really get to see many elk in the east, and they're over there walking around on Cataloochee Creek now.
Yeah, they probably like those meadows that you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And anything specific there? What are you catching there? Primarily the rainbows and browns?
Rainbows and browns in Cataloochee Creek. And
right.
It's that valley there, and it's got a number of tributaries, and there's a good number of brook trout streams that come into that. You have to walk up to get to the brook trout, and even then you've got some rainbows mixed in here and there. But that's primarily a rainbow and brown trout stream. And actually, almost anywhere in the Smokies where you have rainbows and browns, you're going to be catching a lot more rainbows than browns, just as a rule.
Okay.
And even in some of the streams that are, like, evenly distributed, it's like the brown trout just kind of account for 10% of the creel surveys usually.
Okay.
They're a lot tougher fish to fool.
Well, we need to take another break, Ian. So when we come back, we'll answer more questions about tactics and techniques fishing for trout in southern Appalachia. Women's fly fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's fly fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group-guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome, and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's www.womensflyfishing.net. Or email them at Pudge, and that's P-U-D-G-E, at womensflyfishing.net, or call 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Ian Rutter about Southern Appalachia trout fishing. If you'd like to ask Ian a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and click on the link below the description of the show that says, click here to ask Ian your most important question. We'll receive your questions immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So, Ian, I'm going to move on here to Abrams Creek, which is another, I mean, these are the names of creeks we hear about out west, you know.
Okay. Well,
as much as you hear about the Madison and the Bighorn, we hear about these. So.
Okay. Well, Abrams Creek actually is just over the ridge from me in a straight line. It's probably closer to me than Little River at Elkmont that I fish so frequently. It's in the Cades Cove section of Smoky Mountain National Park, which is actually the most visited quadrant of the park. It's a beautiful valley with original pioneer structures, and it's a one-way loop road that goes around it. It's got a lot of open meadows and fields, and because of that, you can actually see a lot of wildlife. You can see the deer. It's a great place to see bears, which you know a lot of people want to see here in the Smokies. And for that reason, it can be kind of difficult to get to because there's usually a lot of traffic on that one-lane, one-way road to Abrams Creek. So when you get there, there probably won't be that many people fishing it. It's a predominantly rainbow trout stream, and it has some of the better rainbows in the national park that are in it. And usually I'm going to tell people that in the Smokies, a 12-inch rainbow is topping out. You know, you might get the odd 13-inch rainbow, but that's really just you've hit the ceiling. And Abrams Creek, you can do better than that. And not that there's 16-inch rainbows just running all over the place in there, but they do exist in Abrams Creek. And it has a little more fertile base. The valley there in Cades Cove is limestone, so it has a little more mineral content, so those fish can get a little more calcium in their system to grow a little bigger skeleton and get a little bit larger there. And it has real good caddis hatches in the spring. So
now, what does it look like fishing there? Is there Is that
It's not as bouldery as most trout streams in the Smokies. It's got a lot flatter gradient, kind of long riffles and glides more than plunge pools and boulders. And
is it a canopy type as far as the forest goes there?
Yeah, about the same as the other streams. It's probably 30 to 40 feet wide most of the way. And like I said, just a lot of riffles. And it does eventually turn into a smallmouth stream before it leaves the national park. And if you were to look at a map of the national park, you'll see an Abrams Creek campground. And I can't tell you how many people I've talked to over the years that say they stayed there and were so disappointed. You know, they heard of the famous Abrams Creek and camped there and didn't catch a trout. And the reason was that they were fishing in water that it's too warm for trout in August. Yeah, they were in the smallmouth section of the stream. And it's a good smallmouth stream. It's about the same size. But they needed to walk up stream a ways to get into more reliable trout fishing.
We do have a question from David in Warner Robins, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
He says, is there a particular tactic or fly that you use to target the bigger rainbows in Abrams Creek?
Not really. I would say that Abrams Creek is probably more reliable, and particularly the bigger fish are this way, on nymphs. You're probably not going to catch the bigger fish on dry fly so much. Well, the rainbows are a lot more willing to eat, period, than brown trout are in other places. So you don't have to resort to special techniques as much there to catch a better fish as you would maybe on Little River or Cataloochee or something trying to get hold of a better brown trout. Again, I would say 14 to 16-inch rainbows are a possibility on Abrams Creek, but don't be disappointed, you know, if you don't catch one, because it's still a rare fish, but still a distinct possibility there.
What when you're fishing, nymphing in these types of streams, are you do you ever use a dropper method, or are you just fishing one nymph? Or
A little bit. If I'm nymphing personally, I like to use two nymphs without a strike indicator, and that's just the way I do it, and when I'm guiding, I don't usually do that for folks because they have a tough time kind of picking up on the strike, and it requires really good line control to sense that take, and usually some anticipation as well to really picture where that nymph is in the water and think it's coming right about where the fish ought to be and watch for the strike. So usually I'll put on maybe a Prince nymph or a Teleco nymph. That might be a 10 or a 12, and then a beadhead pheasant tail above that that's a 14 or 16, and have the bottom fly being about 3 feet from the strike indicator, and the flies maybe 10 or 12 inches apart. And that's kind of a winter and spring thing for me. I don't fish the flies quite like that in the summer. In the summer, I might use like a stimulator or a bigger foam ant, almost a Chernobyl, not a true giant western-sized Chernobyl, but, you know, maybe like a 12 or something with a beadhead pheasant tail dropper or a stimulator with a 16 beadhead pheasant tail dropper.
You've talked a lot about dry fly fishing.
Do
people come there for the dry fly fishing? Is there more dry fly fishing there than other places, you know, like out west here?
I don't know if there's more, although you can just about get by in life being a dry fly purist here. I'll say that. You don't really have to resort to the nymph to catch fish, that often. I know that, like I said, there's folks from the upper Midwest and Northeast that I've noticed them on the streams and around spring break because of the early hatches here. But the fish always tend to look up, and the water here is really clear. I mean, as clear a water as I've ever fished anywhere I've been for trout. And most of the water isn't that deep. I'd say most of the water is 3 feet deep or less. So I think a lot of times, if you're in a stream that's, you know, you've got an average depth of 2 feet deep, even if a fish is hunkered down on bottom, the surface is still right there.
Yeah, yeah.
And the water is exceptionally clear. So I think they see those flies on the top, and even if they are kind of in a nymph state of mind, they'll still consider rising a good bit of the time.
Are they, would you say, any spookier than...
Absolutely, yes.
They are, okay.
Yeah, yeah. When the water's low and we're in a bit of a drought right now, I always tell people, you know, don't slam the car door, you know, because they will spook. And when I'm on Little River, I'll walk along the edge of the road kind of looking down, and you'll see fish, and, every, you know, every so often you'll see them blow out and run off, and people will say, well, what scared them? And I'll say, us. And they'll say, you mean they saw us up here on the road? And I'll say, yeah. Absolutely. And when I'm fishing any of these streams, I really try to stay out of the water as much as possible. You know, I'll be driving up the river, and I'll see guys up to their, you know, their belly button or more in the middle of the river, wading right up the middle of the river. And, I mean, they've just shot the pool when they're doing that. I mean, it's over.
That's a good tip.
Unless the fish are just rising with reckless abandon, I mean.
Yeah.
You've pretty well killed it. You just need to stay out of the water as much as possible, and keep moving too, because no matter what, you just the very act of fishing is going to put fish down. I mean, any fish that you don't catch is going to wise up and just not eat, and you just got to move on and get to the next uneducated fish would be the best way to put it.
Right. Well, let's talk about Hazel Creek, another famous place.
Oh, absolutely. And that is probably famous because it's one of the most remote trout streams in the eastern United States. To get there, you have to walk about 20 miles or take a boat across Fontana Lake to get to it. And Hazel Creek is kind of an interesting place in that for this part of the country, it was one of the first places with electricity and all types of stuff. But after World War II and the construction of dams, it became isolated and is now one of the furthest out-of-the-way places there is. And it's a good rainbow trout stream, brown trout stream, and further up, it's got brook trout. And I will say, it for as remote as it is, it gets a fair amount of pressure, pretty much from Memorial Day on into October. On any given weekend, you're going to find a lot of guys backpacked in there or set up a camp specifically to go fishing. So I would always recommend people try to get in there on a weekday, even though it's so remote. Try to go on a weekday. Once it's summer, you want to move on up the creek, down closer to Fontana Lake. It'll be okay, but the fishing will be better if you move on up the creek a little ways toward Bone Valley. Water will be cooler up there, and the fish will be a lot more agreeable. And everybody else that's come over for the weekend may not have gotten that high, so you'll find less educated fish when you move that far up, too. It's a decent-sized stream. It's not that small.
Is there shuttle service across Fontana Lake?
Yeah, you can get a shuttle at the Fontana Marina at Fontana Village. It's kind of a resort, and there is a boat marina near the dam, and you can get a shuttle. I think it's pretty pricey. I think it's about $50 round trip for that. But you know, it's easier than a 20-mile walk too.
Yeah, yeah.
There is a National Forest boat ramp where you can take a canoe or your own boat for that matter, and run yourself across Fontana Lake.
How far is it?
It's by boat. It's probably a 15 or 20 minute ride. If you're in a canoe, it'll probably take you an hour, hour and a half to get over there. And it's not really a difficult, you know, trip at all. And you just need to be sure your boat's tied down good when you leave it, so it's there when you get back.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a bit finally about one other area, which is more noted as a tailwater fishery, and that's the Nantahala.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing we haven't talked about here on any of these locations yet is public versus private. And I know there's some private water on the Nantahala, but can you kind of address that in general and then more specifically on the Nantahala?
Yeah, well, the Nantahala is mostly, not entirely, but mostly in the Nantahala National Forest, which, you know, that makes a good deal of it public right there. And really, you know, any of the streams we've been talking about that are inside the national park or a few others I kind of mentioned in passing that are in these national forests. We have the Cherokee National Forest, Pisgah National Forest, and Nantahala National Forest. And all these streams are on public land, which is a really cool thing that we've got all these hundreds, if not thousands of miles of trout stream on public land. And the Nantahala, which you just brought up, the tailwater section of it kind of goes in and out of the forest, but there's pretty good access pretty much. That tailwater section runs right alongside a road there, so you've got good access without really any trouble whatsoever.
And where is that, the tailwater?
It's kind of in a little corner of North Carolina between Bryson City and Andrews and Franklin, kind of nondescript. There's not really anything there. The NOC, or Nantahala Outdoor Center, is probably the biggest thing on the river there, and it's a whitewater center where they do whitewater rafting and kayak lessons, and it's a big outdoor outfitter and everything, and that's kind of the big focal point there on the river. There's the Appalachian Trail goes right by there, by the Nantahala River, too. So there's not really much civilization right there in terms of, you know, you're not going to have a Walmart or anything nearby. But it's probably, you know, within 30 minutes of Bryson City and probably about 45 minutes out of Andrews and about an hour or so from Franklin. And Robbinsville, it's about 20 or 30 minutes from Robbinsville, North Carolina.
Now, do you drift that tailwater, or is it waiting?
If you're drifting it, you've got to do it in a raft, and you really got to know what you're doing at the oars. And it's not like it's a big man-eater of a river or anything, but it's relatively narrow for the amount of current that it's got. And there's a lot of traffic on the Nantahala tailwater, but it's almost all whitewater enthusiasts. You got guys in kayaks and people and rafts. And it's because it's got some bumps and, you know, and waves and stuff. So you need to know how to operate the raft if you're going to be fishing from it.
Sounds similar to the Arkansas out here in Colorado.
Sure.
Where it's just bouldery enough that you wouldn't take a drift boat because you'd end up banging it up. But
yeah.
You can take a raft.
Exactly. And it's just really narrow in spots. You know, there'll be islands and little channels and stuff that makes it pretty difficult to negotiate. The way a lot of folks fish it is that this time of year, in the hot summer, and it's covered up with rafts and everything, is that it usually runs from about 9 in the morning to 5 in the afternoon, roughly. And once the last set of rafts puts in before they turn the river off, people will start kind of fishing from the upper end near the powerhouse and working their way down. And then once it falls out after they turned it off, it becomes very easy to wade. And the fish will start, you know, feeding pretty good in the evening. I like to go over in the fall and over in the spring as well before the whitewater crowd really gets fired up and fish it with the high water some. And I know that most people really don't care to fish it with the high water. They prefer it with the low water. But I've always enjoyed fishing the high water and fishing big nymphs and fishing streamers. And I've always done pretty good. I've never personally caught any great big fish out of the Nantahala, but I know several people who have caught some really nice fish, you know, in the 17 to 20-inch range over there.
And you did say a record was caught out of there.
Absolutely, 24-inch brown. And that is a stocked river that also has a lot of wild fish in it. It has a lot of nice wild browns, wild rainbows. And actually, come to think of it, last winter I caught about an 18-inch brook trout out of the Nantahala tailwater, and I'm sure he didn't grow up from a little baby fish in that river. But that was a fun fish. And just upstream of the powerhouse is a section of the river that a lot of people in this part of the country are familiar with. It's what they call the delayed harvest section. And in October, North Carolina stocks that section of the stream pretty intensively. And it's catch and release only until June. And then at that point, they open it up to keeping fish. And that's because that section of the river kind of has marginal water temperatures. So the state does what they can to make that a really good fishing opportunity. And they stock a lot of pretty good-sized fish in that section of the river. And it's a lot of fun to fish in the winter and the spring particularly. And it's a good place to take folks who are brand new to it, want to catch some fish and kind of hone their skills, get better at it. You know, you don't have to be a real super-duper angler to catch some nice fish, like just, you know, a mile or two down below the powerhouse. Those fish are going to be a little more difficult and a little more selective.
Well, we're running out of time here, Ian, but I do want to address a couple of conservation questions that came in, because I know you're concerned about that, and of course we all are. But Phil B. in Laramie, Wyoming, seems to know something about it. Can you talk about the current status of the dam, and the dam has an N on it, so
yeah.
I think he's cursing the North Shore Road proposal. And he says, having fished Eagle, Hazel, and others, I recognize the impending devastation. Please illuminate this issue to the listeners. So can you tell us what he's talking about?
Yes, I do, and I don't have too much time to go into the history of it, but about the time the park was formed and the Fontana Lake was formed and everything, Hazel Creek, where I was talking about being such a remote area and was actually a pretty good-sized town at one time, when that was kind of cut off from the rest of the world, there was a promise or some sort of proposal put forth to build a road to that area. And it later became part of the national park, which I don't think it was originally intended to be. So there's been a lot of dickering for almost 70 years now, you know, over 60 years, about whether or not they're ever going to build this road. And now it's one of the most pristine wilderness areas left in the eastern United States, and there's a pretty vocal contingent of people that have been clamoring to get their road back over there to that, you know, to that area. And one of the options has been to give a cash settlement to the county over there to give these folks a cash settlement in lieu of having the road over there, because now it's in a highly valued wilderness area. And they've had some other kind of compromise things come and go. And with the last big election for the Senate, Heath Shuler, who was a star quarterback at University of Tennessee, who was from Western North Carolina, was elected to Congress from that area, and he is dead set against that road, and the senators here from Tennessee are dead set against that road. And I think it was the previous congressmen in North Carolina that were really for it. So it seems like all the people that were for it are not there anymore, and nothing has really been put to bed yet, but it does seem as if the road thing is going to be kind of shut down entirely, and the cash settlement will be given to the Western North Carolina County over there to take the money. We won't be cutting any more roads into the Smokies. And if they were going to do that, it was going to take like 30 years to build this road, and goodness knows how much money, and they were going to be, you know, really just, you know, building a road to a pristine mountain area too. So
Well, one final thing. Curtis Reiner, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, he says, in your years of fishing the streams in southern Appalachia, have you noticed any trends in the quality of these fisheries? If you've noticed a negative trend, what do you think are the causes of the decline in quality? So make this a quick answer, because we've got to finish up.
Probably not too much of a difference, although I do hear that acid rain is affecting brook trout streams at the highest elevations adversely. Just it doesn't have time to buffer out. So there's brook trout are losing some ground at the very highest elevations throughout the region. But other than that, I think everything seems to be pretty good.
Well, good, good. Well, let's take a final break here, and we'll be back in a minute. I'll be giving away again Ian's book, Rise, Rings, and Rhododendron, Fly Fishing, the Mountain Streams and Tailwaters of Southern Appalachia, and that 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and that 1-year subscription to the Fly Fusion. So stay tuned. We'll be giving those away shortly. Just as Lance Armstrong says, live strong, there is a fly fishing organization that's helping women battle cancer to fish on. It's Reeling and Healing Midwest. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling in all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature, and support network, which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and to learn how you can help support their retreats, visit www.reeling, and the word and spelled out, A-N-D, healingmidwest.org. So reelingandhealingmidwest.org or ifishon.org or call 866-237-5725. That's 866-237-5725. Well, from our global events calendar, we see the Florida Council of the Federation of Fly Fishers is putting on a public fly casting clinic in Tallahassee, Florida on July 14th. The class is focused on novice and intermediate anglers of all ages. The instructions will be Dusty Sprague, Jim Penrod, Tom Logan, and Captain Pete Greenan. The cost is $45 for non-members, $25 for members, and all non-members who participate will receive a free membership in the Federation of Fly Fishers. So to find out more information, go to our global events calendar on our website. The link is near the bottom of every page on our site, and look under Florida for more information. And by the way, fly shops, clubs, you can all list your fly fishing related events in our global events calendar. It's free. You can do it yourself. Go to the events calendar and get started. Get your events out there for everyone to see. Classes, demos, clinics, shows, schools, anything related to fly fishing. We'll be highlighting one event from the calendar on each of our shows. Well, just a reminder before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what do you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd sure appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away a copy, an autographed copy of Ian's book, Rise, Rings, and Rhododendron, Fly Fishing the Mountain Streams and Tailwaters of Southern Appalachia. And the way that we do this is the winners are randomly drawn from our registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show yet, it's too late, but make sure you do it for the next show because you don't want to miss out on a lot of the incredible prizes we have to offer, like Ian's book. Well, Ian, let's give away your book here. I'm going to press the magic button and see who we get.
Okay.
And the winner is, this will be good, David Fritz, and David lives in Georgia.
All right.
So he ought to be able to make instant and great use out of your book, I think.
Yeah.
So that's nice of someone in the area that'll be able to take advantage of that. Yeah. So, David, when you after you read the book, go visit Ian up there and go fishing. Now we have two other winners. One will be for the 3-year membership of for the Fly Fishing Federation, and that's going to be Robert Warren. Robert Warren, and he's in Washington. So, Robert, congratulations. And then our final winner is going to be for Fly Fusion Magazine. Let's see who that is. And that will be Paul Woodrow, and he's in Australia.
Wow.
Australia. So, as usual, we have people all over the world listening to our show, which is rather nice. So those are winners. Congratulations, everyone. I know you're going to enjoy whatever prize you won. And again, register next time for the prizes next time. Ian, we really appreciate you being on the show with us tonight. And thanks for taking time to share your experiences and your knowledge with us about the Southern Appalachia. We hope you'll return again. Maybe we can talk in more detail about smallmouth or some other subject.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Well, thanks a lot, and we really enjoyed it. Let me tell you folks about what's happening next on our show. Our next broadcast will be on July 11th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. And on that show, we'll interview Mike Reeser, and our topic for the show will be roosterfish on the fly in Baja. Always innovative, Mike Reeser has developed tactics and fly patterns effective on a wide variety of species that swim in the Sea of Cortez. On this show, we're going to focus on one of his favorites, the roosterfish. Learn Mike's secrets on fly fishing for this challenging fish. But we'd like to thank the Mystic River on the Nantahala, the Federation of Fly Fishers, Front Range Anglers, Women in Fly Fishing, and Reeling and Healing Midwest for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you won't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. And feel free to explore the other areas of our site like the events calendar and the directories. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.